being in public service is a great sacrifice, but of course a great honor and privilege. And so I am honored and privileged to be with all of you today. In 2009, people talked about me as a rising star in the state of Missouri. I'd run in 2004 for U.S. Congress. I was in a 10-way congressional primary against eight guys and one guy named Carnahan, which is always tough in Missouri politics. I was a political science professor, and after my race, we had a lot of young people involved, a lot of my students. In fact, we had 650 college students or even high school students who volunteered on the campaign and really provided a jolt of energy. And they made a documentary film about the campaign called Can Mr. Smith Get to Washington Anymore? And that got a little bit of publicity. And then I came back, went away for a year to teach at a school called Dartmouth in New Hampshire. And then I came back and I ran for the state senate in 2006 in a district in the city of St. Louis. It was an interesting district. It was 58% black, 7% Latino, 6% Asian, 5% African, about 15% gay and lesbian. I joke that I was one of only about a dozen straight white men in the district. But we ran kind of with an unusual, you know, message and an unusual strategy. And I alternated every day for a year. One day, those of you who know St. Louis know that there's sort of a racial demarcation line of Del Mar Boulevard. North of Del Mar, about 95% of people are black. South of Del Mar, most are white. And we decided we'd have sort of an ethos, which was an attempt to represent the diversity of the district, which we alternated days. One day we'd knock on doors north of Del Mar, the next day south of Del Mar. We did that for a year. And I was blessed to win that race. I went to Jefferson City. Was able to get some good legislation passed, and I'll touch a little bit on that shortly. I was 32 years old. People talked about me as a leading candidate for mayor, or one day, maybe even governor or U.S. senator. That was 2009. In 2010, I spent my days in a giant warehouse freezer, a freezer that was about half as big as this room, with six former crack dealers, catching and throwing 80-pound boxes and 100-pound bags of sugar, rice, wheat, and flour. Today I'm going to explain a little bit how that happened. But first, I'm going to talk about how I got myself into that position in the first place and talk a little bit about my campaign so you'll understand, I think, the picture in a little broader context. So when I decided to run for Congress, I was 29 years old. It was almost 10 years ago. And so as you can imagine, I looked pretty young. And so I didn't know if people would take me seriously as a candidate or not. I was teaching as an adjunct at Washington University. And I decided to get a better sense of whether or not people would take me seriously that I'd go and just knock on doors one day before I made my decision and tell, you know, everybody in this neighborhood what my hopes were and see if they took me seriously. And so I crossed the street, I went to the first door, I said, hi, my name's Jeff Smith. I'm planning to run for office next year. I wanted to come by and just see if you had any questions for me at all. And it was a woman, and she asked me how I felt about, man, I'm going to kill myself in this room when I say this, but asked me how I felt about gun control. And I told her I didn't support the concealed carry bill, or that at the very least, I thought it should be put back to a lower level of government, maybe like the counties. And she said to me, I agree with that. You know, I'd support you. Then got to the second door, very similar interaction on a different issue, ended very well. The person said, hey, you know, I'd support you. Got to the third door, I said, you know, gave my spiel. It was a middle-aged woman. And she said, where are you coming from? I said, well, I'm just coming from right across the street from campus. And she said, oh, I understand. Hold on one second. Janie, come on downstairs. There's a young fellow here. He's running for your student government. And of course, at that point, I was too embarrassed to explain that I was running for U.S. Congress. And so I just sort of skulked away. But overall, the response was pretty good that day, and so I decided to do it. My friends in Washington, D.C., they told me, if you want to get elected to Congress, you know, these are big money races. And what you really need to do is just sit in a call room, and some of you have probably done this, just sit in a call room and call people on the phone and ask them for money. Just find a list of all the people who've given $1,000 or more to Democratic politicians in the area. Just go through the list, ask them all for $1,000, and when you get $500,000, take a poll, figure out what the three things people really want to hear are, and then spend the other $490,000 running television ads saying whatever the poll told you to say. Now, that didn't seem like a very edifying way to run for office for me. Plus, no one would give me money. And so I decided to do it a little different way. And that meant really engaging young people, and in particular, my students and former students. And I got invitations to go and speak to my colleagues' classes, and then different universities, and then different high schools, and it just sort of snowballed. It was a 10-way primary, and I know it sounds sort of rather quixotic to think that you could win a congressional race by just getting a bunch of young people excited to go out and knock on doors, but there was a little bit of method to the madness. It was a 10-way primary, and that, of course, reduces the number of votes that you need to win to the point where a real grassroots campaign, such as one that you'd run for county commission, can really matter. And I took some unequivocal stances on issues. I decided that my only way to success was going to be different, and so I just didn't hedge on any issues. People asked me how I felt, and I told them. And I could do that because I was just going for a very small niche out of that race. I thought I could win with 22 or 23%. Now, of course, getting to 22 or 23 wasn't easy. When we took our first poll, Mr. Carnahan's name ID was 99%, and mine was 3. And my communications director, he always said to me, if I ever got feeling too cocky about anything, he'd say, hey, you remember that 3% name ID? I'd say, yeah. He'd say, well, 2% of that 3% had just heard of someone named Jeff Smith. Which, of course, is the double-edged sword of having a common name. And, you know, name is such a big deal in Missouri politics, and especially in St. Louis. You know, we have the Carnahans and the Blunts on the statewide level. In Missouri, we have the Slays and the Clays, you know, who have gone against each other in St. Louis for so many decades. And I remember when one of the downsides of my last name is there was another guy named Smith in the race. His name was Mark Smith. And to make matters even more confusing, he also taught at Washington University. So there's one Carnahan and two Smiths who work at the same place. And I went into his office when I announced I was going to run, and I said, hey, you know, he had a long history as a professor. He had served on the St. Louis Police Board. He had worked at Bryan Cave, which is the biggest law firm in St. Louis. And so he had a pretty, you know, he had a much deeper background than I did. And so I said, hey, I'll make you a deal. Well, two Smiths, one Carnahan, neither one of us is going to win. So why don't we see who can raise more money for the first 3 months, and then whoever raises less will drop out and endorse the other. He said no. I said, okay. So I went, and I had a really good first fundraising quarter, and raised over $100,000 that first quarter, and then I got a phone call from him, because at first he just wasn't taking me seriously at all. And then he called me and he said, he was with his campaign manager, and his campaign manager said, listen, what would it take to get you out of the race? I said, I'm not going anywhere. You had your chance to try to get me out of the race and you missed it. He said, what is it you want? You want money? I said, no, I'm not in this for money. He said, you want power. You want the power, don't you? Well, we will give you the opportunity to be Mark's chief of staff in Washington, D.C. I said, well, Mark's not going to win. I said, I will give you one opportunity to get me out of the race. tonight. Now, he was about 6'5", 6'6". And I said, I'll play you one-on-one at any basketball hoop in the city. I'll play you in your backyard. And you got a foot on me. And so if you're not, you know, tough enough to take that bet, then you'll never have a chance to win anyway. And I never heard back on that. And so he remained in the race. And I went down for the filing. And the woman looked at my identification. You know, when you go down and file for office, they want to make sure you are who you say you are. And I gave her, she asked for multiple forms, and so I gave her my license, my social security card, and then a professional ID. And she said, well, how do you want to be known on the ballot? As Jeff Smith, Jeffrey Smith, or Jeffrey R. Smith? And I said, is it my choice? She said, yes. I said, well, then I'd like to be known as Richard A. Gephardt. And she, you know, you could tell she'd been in state government for a long time. And she just looked at me, stone cold face, and she said, well, we might need to bring in a lawyer for that. But name is very important, and it's really hard to make the case to anyone that you have a plausible chance to win when you're a total unknown. I'm sure when some of you ran for the first time, you were the unknown in the race, the upstart, the person running against the established name in your county. And it's not easy. It's a constant fight every day to just get people aware of your name. And it's harder even when your own family doesn't support you. My parents told me it was the craziest thing they'd ever heard. I asked them for money. My mom said, not only am I not giving you money, but if I hear any inkling that you're asking any of my friends or any of our relatives for money, I'd like to disown you. My grandma was 95 at that point. She was an amazing woman. Up until she was 98, she walked on a treadmill for an hour a day. She played in a bridge game twice a week. She went through four different bridge games, the one in her 60s, then they died, then the one in her 70s when they were in their 60s, then the one in her 80s, then in her 90s, and everyone kept dying on her. And she, if you ask her the secret to her longevity, she'd always say it's real simple. 1 hour of exercise every day and 2 vodka martinis every night. And she went to her bridge game when she was 95, and one of her bridge partners said, Ida, I got a letter here from your grandson. He's running for Congress. Where do I give him, how do I send him some money? And she was, you know, she was pretty sharp. Once in a while she got confused. She said, no, he's not running for Congress. He's running for the State House. The woman said, no, Ida, he's running for Congress. I've got it right here. Where do I send him a check? And, you know, can I just give it to you? And my grandma said, well, if he's really running for U.S. Congress, if I were you, I would save your money. But fortunately, there was another woman who got engaged in my campaign who was not much younger than my grandma. She was about 80 years old, and she was an heir to the Dayton Hudson fortune, the Target department store fortune. And she had been a staunch advocate of like every liberal cause in St. Louis for decades and decades. She's one of those people, she had a car, and you're in politics and so you know people that have bumper stickers, like just covering the whole bumper. Well, her bumper stickers didn't cover her bumper. Her bumper stickers covered her car, okay? With every liberal cause, you know, that she had fought for and served on boards on over the last 50 years. And her real passion was affordable housing. And so I was able to get an audience with her, and I sat down with her and she said, listen, Jeff, Bernie and I, that was her husband, she said, we are sick and tired of these no-account politicians. They talk a good game when they run for office, and then they never do what they're going to say, and we can never get back with them after we've given them the money. And so we decided we're not giving any more contributions. And she was worth about $500 million. And I said, well, I'm sorry to hear that. She said, and if you still want to spend an hour talking, then I will. But I think that, you know, you probably have better ways to spend your time. And I said, well, I hear you, but aside from the money, I know you've been involved in a ton of interesting causes in your life, and I just love to hear, you know, your thoughts and your stories and your advice. And so she talked for about an hour about fighting, especially on affordable housing for people who were struggling. And I learned a lot. And I wrote her a handwritten thank you note. I did that for everybody I met with for a year. And she called me about a week later, and she said, Jeff, no one writes handwritten notes anymore. I said, well, you know, I'm trying. And she said, well, I'd like to help you. You seem like a good kid. And so I said, I'm not going to give you any money, and we're not. But I'm going to just make a list of some friends, people I've served on boards with over the last several decades. I'm going to send it to you, and, you know, you can do with it whatever you like. I said, thank you so much. That's really considerate of you. I appreciate it. About an hour later, the fax machine started whirring, and she sent a list of 880 people, coded by zip code, and the organization that she'd worked on with them. And it also had, after all the 880 people, she had a couple paragraphs that she'd written. And she said, I've sent them this about you. And it was this lovely, you know, it read as if she'd known me my whole life. Just talking about how wonderful I was, comparing me to Bobby Kennedy and saying, I hope you'll support him. And I called her and I told her I was just overwhelmed that she would do that for me. And I asked her, would you mind if I followed up with these people? And she said, well, you said you are a grassroots candidate. I didn't give you the list for your health. So I started calling the people, and every phone call was almost exactly the same. I'd call and say, hey, my name's Jeff Smith. I'm calling to follow up on the letter that Janet Becker sent. I'm not sure if you, oh, I remember. How can I help you? Do you want me, bring me a yard sign? Do you want me to host a coffee? You probably need some money. I'll send you $100. We'll figure out a time. I'll host a coffee and we'll get some of my friends and neighbors over. So I start with these coffees. I ended up having 93 coffees at people's houses, you know, to give a little talk over the course of about 8 months. And the first, probably 25 of the first 30 were all Janet Becker's friends. And so one at a time, I'd raise, you know, $600 one night and $400 another night. And I kept doing it. And then about 6 weeks later, Janet called the office. And she said, I am just getting in touch with all these people that I haven't talked to in 20, 30, 40 years, because they're calling me after, you know, saying that they had a great coffee with you. And it's just been so wonderful to get in touch with these people again. And Bernie and I, we've decided to make one exception to our pledge about contributions. We're going to send you $25. But those coffees are really the key to get us started. And, you know, we did it, you know, again, really thanks to our volunteers. Just all of you, you know, have run, and you know just that no amount of money can compare to somebody that'll just be a totally dedicated person, that'll go and tell all their friends, tell everybody they work with, tell all their family, you know, that you're a good person. Nothing else really compares. And so, you know, we had, you know, I remember so many of our volunteers. That the one I remember the best was this woman who, she came, just popped into our office one day, didn't have any idea who I was, but she hated one of my opponents. And as, you know, most of you know, the enemy of your enemy is always a very, very passionate friend. And she told me she wanted to do, you know, help however she could. She was struggling. She was out of work. She was on public assistance. You know, we'd buy her a meal when she'd come and help, but, you know, that was, you know, pretty much the extent of what we did for her. But she came in, you know, just faithfully. She had burnt kind of orange hair, and she'd wear, you know, kind of crazy hats. She was very eccentric. And the interesting thing about her being on public assistance is that she would drive this Escalade into work. You guys know what I mean? Like a $50,000 SUV. And we always wondered how she got that. And then after about 3 or 4 months, one day, she calls us and she says, I'd like, could one of you guys give me a ride to work? And we picked her up. And we had asked her a month before, hey, where'd you get that snazzy car? She had just said, in Iowa. And so we figured she bought it at a dealership in Iowa. And then we learned the truth, which was she had volunteered for Howard Dean's campaign in Iowa. And one day when Governor Dean was coming into town, there was no one at the office to pick him up at the airport. And they just grabbed her and said, would you mind going and getting him at the airport? And she never took the rental car back a year earlier. The great thing about volunteers is that you can't fire them. So that was sort of, I remember, one of our early ethical dilemmas. You know, should we say anything to anyone about that? And we didn't. We figured she was probably a good person who just, made a mistake. Mistake of enthusiasm. She was struggling. She didn't figure anyone was really getting hurt by it, But it was sort of one of the first times when I knew something was right. I probably should have told the authorities that she did that, but I didn't. And that was one in a series of ethical dilemmas that I ended up facing. Some were, seemed really trivial at the time, but can end up having an impact. One I remember that really seemed so trivial. I was at a Pride Fest parade. That's the big gay rights parade they have every year on South Grand Boulevard in St. Louis. And I was walking, and I was with, a couple of my staff, and I was, parades are the best. You're just running back and forth and shaking all these hands and, getting to touch all these people. And I remember having a group of guys, and they said, Jeff, come over here, Jeff! And so I run over there, and I shake their hands, and one of them hollers at me, hey, Jeff, are you single? And at that point, I was dating a woman, but, I just was sort of cryptic with him, and I pointed at my ring finger, and I said, you know it! And I kept walking. Which, wasn't exactly forthright with them, but, you're in a parade. You don't have time to stop and give anybody your life story. So I said, yeah, sure, I'm single. And then the rumors started about me. And then the phone call started, the robocalls that sometimes politicians or candidates do about their opponents. And the last week of the campaign, there was a flyer that went out. I was running in a congressional district that was about a third St. Louis City, a third St. Louis County, but about a third of it was Jefferson County and St. Genevieve, so a little more rural. And the flyer that came out that last week, it had a picture of me, and it had two pictures of me. It had one picture of me with like the most flamboyant looking man they could find, and then a second picture of me, which I rarely wear like a suit jacket. I used to wear it, but then I'd usually just put it behind me. So they shot the picture with me with my jacket behind me, but they photoshopped out the jacket, so it was just a picture of me like this. And it said, Jeff Smith supports gay marriage. Ever wonder why? So that was an anonymous mailer. We never figured out who did it. I mean, we had a pretty good hunch who did it, but we never knew. And speaking of anonymous mailers, the little mistake, which turned into a bigger mistake that I made, revolves around an anonymous mailer. One of my aides, actually two of my aides, ran into a guy at an event, a guy named Skip Olson. You may have read about him in the Post-Dispatch over the last few years. And he had a meeting, uh, he with these two aides of mine, and he said, hey, here's what I want to do. I don't like the Carnahans. I'm tired of them being in Missouri politics. I want to help your guy. So I'd like to do a negative mailer about them. And this guy was a little bit shady. He had come to us months earlier. He had wanted to do our television ads, and I didn't have a good feel about him, and so I declined. And now he was coming back through my aide saying that he wanted to do this independent mailer. And at that point, you know, I was really frustrated. Because the media, you know, wouldn't, every quarter, they weren't really covering our race, in my opinion, very thoroughly. Every 3 months, they'd write the same story. Russ Carnahan has all the endorsements. He's 30 points ahead in the polls. He's on track to raise $1 million. He can't lose this race. Instead of coming to the forums and listening to us talk about issues and writing about the differences between the candidates, which is what we wanted. And I was frustrated. So all the newspapers were endorsing opponents of mine. And this guy, who wanted to do this mailer, he wanted to get out this information about my opponent's attendance record. My opponent had a pretty dismal attendance record when he served in the State House of Representatives. And we were trying to get them to write about that, and they didn't want to write about it. And I had a choice when my staff came back to me. I knew that they shouldn't coordinate anything with him. Okay, because although I didn't know the fine print of the federal election law, I knew enough to know that an independent operation that was going to put out some communication shouldn't be coordinating with the campaign. And so when they asked my permission to give Skip the go-ahead, I didn't say, don't ever meet with him again. I didn't even say, why don't you look into this guy a little bit more before you talk with him? Instead, I said, I don't want to know the details. Don't tell me anything. I was very competitive. I'd been competitive my whole life. I played basketball my whole life. I know it probably doesn't look like that. But when I was a little kid, my dad, when I was like 8, 9 years old, he used to take me and drop me off in the middle of North St. Louis, tell me he was going to come pick me up in 3 or 4 hours, and let me go play basketball. It was his dream that I was going to play in the NBA. He would come back and get me, take me home, give me a story to tell my mom that we were playing golf, something like that. And so I played basketball my whole life, and I was tenacious because I was the smallest kid on just about every court I ever played on, and hyper-competitive. And that carried over into my political style. And I'd spent a year of my life and most of my savings that I loaned to my campaign trying to win. And it was a race in which I was confident that I was the best candidate. Even though I didn't have the most political experience, I didn't have a name anybody had ever heard of, I didn't have the most money. But I was frustrated, you know, that I didn't feel like there was, you know, enough attention being paid to the substantive differences between the candidates. And Skip told my staff, nobody will ever find out. And so I said, I don't want to know the details. The mailer lacked a disclaimer. You know that little paid for by that you put on your mail? And so that gave the Carnahan campaign an opening to file an ethics complaint. So they file this complaint, and that was about a week before the end of the race, and I lost. I lost by a little more than 1%. He had 22 in change, I had 21 in change, and then everybody else. And I went into his office a couple days after the campaign, Mr. Carnahan. I said, hey, I'm going to endorse you. I'm with you in the general election. I'll help you raise money if I can. I'll knock on doors for you. Let me know how I can help. I would ask one small favor. I'd love it if, as a gesture of goodwill, you might drop that FEC complaint, because I knew. And he was there with his brother and his campaign manager, and his brother said, you know, I'm sorry, but the missile's already left the silo. The next week, I went into my lawyer's office and compounded my earlier mistake, and I signed an affidavit. 15 statements on the affidavit. I think that 14 of them were true, but one of them wasn't. It said that I didn't know anything about this mailer that had come out when I knew that two of my aides had met with the guy who did the mailer. And I signed the affidavit. I mean, I could tell you a dozen reasons why I signed it. I was getting ready to move to New Hampshire. I didn't know if I'd ever run for office again. I didn't want to get a big fine when I'd just given so much of my own money to the campaign. I was just wanted to turn the page. Didn't want to put my two staff people who had worked their tails off for me and get them in trouble. Didn't want to get myself in trouble. And I did a calculation on the spot. What are the odds? I mean, don't these complaints get filed? Thousands of them every year? Don't people do worse than that? He won. I didn't win. Why are they going to care? I'm done. And so I went to Jeff City and I began my career in public office. And it was wonderful for a while. As those of you in elective office, most of you know, helping constituents, I mean, there's nothing more rewarding than being able to help somebody one at a time. Being able to craft legislation that helps a lot of people, I mean, that's incredibly rewarding. I was doing what I always dreamed of doing. And of course, once you get elected, all your jokes get funnier, you get better looking, people want to be around you, it's great. And legislatively, even though we were in the minority, as you could tell from the positions I've espoused earlier, probably I was a Democrat, I was able to get some things done. I was able to work on a bill that helped give loan forgiveness to anyone who graduated in the top 10% of their high school class here in Missouri, who would go and study education and agree to teach in an underserved school district. Things that I really cared about, was passionate about. I learned a lot in Jefferson City, but the main thing I learned was to try to get to know people who disagree with me. Travel to their district, see how they lived, try to understand how they see the world. It helped me see where people were coming from, and so I wasn't so quick to vilify them. It helped me clarify my own positions, and most of all, it helped me be effective. I remember I was working on a bill, big problem in St. Louis, in my district, were guys that couldn't pay their child support. And, you know, it's almost like debtor's prison. If you can't pay your child support for a certain number of months, you can get a felony conviction and be locked up. And once you're locked up, obviously, you're not going to be paying your child support. I never realized when I worked on that bill how intimately familiar I would eventually become with how low prison wages were. And when you get a felony conviction, and then you come out of prison, then it's even harder to get a job, and even harder to pay child support. And so I remember I filed this bill. I talked about it with one of my close Republican friends. And he looked at me, he said, "What are you, nuts?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "This is a, you know, conservative Republican House, Senate. You think we're going to go pass a bill to help your inner city deadbeat dads?" And he was a good friend. He was saying that in a, trying to be, he said, "You got to figure out a different way to frame this." And I thought about what he said, and I came back and I presented it to the Senate committee. And I opened my presentation by saying, "I'm going to start by saying something that you'll never hear me say again the whole time I'm serving with you. Dan Quayle was absolutely right when he talked about the importance of having two parents in every household, when he made the joke about Murphy Brown 20 years earlier. And I told him that it was a bill about trying to get fathers back in touch, back engaged in their children's lives. And eventually the bill, which created alternative sentencing, like an alternative court for men who struggle to pay their child support, and give them vocational training and substance abuse counseling and training in how to be a better parent. We were able to pass that unanimously in the Senate. And I was able to have some measure of success because I tried to learn how to put myself in the shoes of people who were raised very differently and had very different ideological orientations and worldviews than did I. And that's a spirit that I think is sorely missing in Washington, D.C. today. And I hope that the next 6 weeks, given the gravity of the problems with which our nation's leaders are grappling, that we'll see more of that spirit. Anyway, years later, Skip Olson, that guy who produced that postcard, got in some other trouble. This is 5 years after that congressional campaign. And now, my best friend, who was then serving in the state house with me, he called me and he said, "Skip Olson, he just got picked up and charged by the feds for drug possession, drug distribution, illegal weapons possession, spousal abuse, mortgage fraud, bank fraud, and he's a suspect in a car bombing." I'd wanted to win that race in 2004 so badly that I'd let my staff get mixed up with this monster without even saying, "I want you to look into this guy's background." Let alone, you know, which of course I should have said, "Don't talk to the guy." And now my best friend was telling me that Skip was in trouble. And I knew what that meant. It meant that he might talk about the connection with that first campaign in order to maybe cut a deal. And so my friend, he called me and we talked all about it and came to my house and we went through all the permutations of, you know, what had happened and what our options were and what we could do. And I said, "You know, I already signed that affidavit 5 years ago, and if I went back on it now, you know, I could get in trouble. The kids who worked for me could get in trouble. I don't know. I think we should just stay the course." So over the course of a couple months, we talked about it frequently. And little did I know that that entire time, my best friend was wearing a wire. And so a few months later, all the worst things I said on tape were taken out of context and splashed across the front pages and aired on the news. And in just a few moments of weakness in that first campaign, I now realized that I'd thrown away everything that I'd worked for in my life. On the day that I found out my best friend was wired, and it's a tough feeling, you know, because, I mean, of course, there's the obvious, you know, that your future's, you know, pretty much at that point, it looks like it's ruined. And then there's just the gut punch of having that happen. And I drove from my lawyers to my parents' house. It was only 5 minutes away, but it was the longest 5 minutes of my life. My mom, in that first race, some of you might have seen the documentary to which I alluded earlier, and my mom is in that documentary, filmed 5 years earlier, telling the documentarian, "I never wanted him to get involved in politics. I never wanted to get him mixed up in all of the mess of politics." So I went to my parents' house, and my mom said, "I knew this was going to happen. I knew it. I told you not to ever run for office. I told you not to get mixed up in this." My dad responded a little more constructively. He said, "Do you have a lawyer? Do you need help? What can we do to help?" Then I went to see my girlfriend. She had moved into my house 2 days before that. And I went to see her at work. And I said, "Listen, baby, this is not good." and I don't know what's going to happen, but I think there's a lot of tapes, and I don't know how much, but I know that I talked in the tapes about knowing that that the affidavit was false. So I think maybe we should just, you know, you should get your stuff. And I won't come home tonight, and that way I don't have to be watching while you take your stuff out. Or if you want me to come and carry it, I'll do it if you don't have anyone else to. But why don't I just give you a night to, you know, make the decision? And she said, I don't need a night. I wasn't with you because you're a politician. And I'm not going to leave you if you're not a politician. And our baby boy just turned one a few weeks ago. We got married in the interim. And so she provided a tremendous source of support for me at a very difficult time. But trust me when I tell you that these conversations, like the ones I had with my parents and my now wife, these are not conversations you ever want to have with your family or your friends. I beg you not to make the same mistakes that I made. Even when you're around people that you think are your best friends, people that you may trust implicitly, don't ever say anything that you wouldn't want a U.S. attorney to hear. Let me give you a few takeaways from my experience and my time in prison. And prison was, it was interesting. When I went in the first day, my wife drove me down, and I went into the intake, and I requested to be at Marion, which is about an hour, 20 minutes or so from my house, maybe 60 miles or so, my old house in St. Louis. And instead they put me 500 miles away, the corner of southeast Kentucky. I got down there, and my wife dropped me off, and you go behind the fence, and you do your intake. And this woman, she says, height and weight? You know, I said 5'6", 120. She said, education level? I said, PhD. And she rolled her eyes. She said, profession? I said, state senator. And she said, well, you're going to fit in just fine here. We got ones that think they're Jesus Christ, too. And they didn't really care about my education. They put me to work in a warehouse, and I worked with, at first, you know, I requested like over and over, I wanted to teach because I've taught for a decade on the outside, and I teach political science. I wanted to try to teach civics in the prison, or teach just, you know, something about like life skills, you know, how to write a resume, how to interview for a job, budget, you know, personal finance. So I kept putting in different applications to teach, but they wouldn't let me teach. They put me in the warehouse, and that was the, you know, they always talk about blessings in disguise, and it was the biggest blessing that anyone ever gave me, probably in my life. Because the people working in the warehouse, there were six guys. They weighed 230, 250, 260, 290, 310, and 350. And when you go into prison at 5'6", 117, it's a good thing to be friends with the six biggest guys in the prison. And I also got myself in great shape. It was, you know, it was hard. We unloaded, you know, for 7 or 8 hours. There were thousands of inmates on the compound and staff as well. And so a lot of days we'd unload 35 to 40,000 pounds of items. But I got in the best shape of my life. And But still, you know, but I had, I fell off a freezer. I fell off about a 12-foot high freezer, and I injured myself. And then I finally was able to get out of the warehouse after that. And it was largely because they put me back in the warehouse, but then Lieutenant Governor Kinder actually came down to see me the day after I fell, a couple days after I fell in the warehouse. And within an hour of the Lieutenant Governor coming, they moved me. It's amazing what, you know, what a little political juice maybe can do. I don't think he said a word to him, but they finally moved me out of the warehouse into the education department. And I was so excited just for my last month to be able to teach. And I got into the education department and they said to me, "What's your education level?" I told them. And the guy threw me a broom. He said, "Okay, we'll start you off sweeping." So I spent my last month sweeping. And that gave me, my whole experience there, it gave me so much appreciation for my education. The other things, obviously, it gives you an appreciation for, you know, are your friends, your family, and your freedom. You know, I live in New York City now, and I ride my bike, I take my bike on a train, and then I ride my bike down from Penn Station to Greenwich Village to teach every day. And when it's raining or freezing, you know, and the cabs are driving like crazy, and really it's not the cabs that are the problem when you're riding your bike in New York City, it's the people on their iPhones. The pedestrians that are walking into the crosswalk like this. But I've had many a day when I think, "God, this weather is horrible, or these people, or these cabbies." Or... But you know what? The thought only goes through my mind for like a split second. And then I think about how much I missed riding my bike for that year. And how great it is to just be able to be in the fresh air on my bike. Rain, snow, be damned. And I finally, I gained a huge appreciation for the tremendous intellect and wasted potential of offenders in our prison system. You wouldn't believe how much entrepreneurial spirit and talent a lot of these guys have. You know, in Harvard Business School, they teach about territorial expansion or branding or new product launches. But these guys know as much about any of those concepts as almost any Ivy School business graduate I know. Of course, they were selling something illegal. But if we can figure out ways to go into prisons and have people with true business experience help explain some of these, you know, some of the concepts of the legal business world, I am confident that that we can produce a new generation of successful entrepreneurs coming out of our federal prisons. You know, Mandela once said, "Resentment is like drinking poison and then hoping it will kill your enemies." And I think about that a lot. When I was in there, there was a guy who was sort of joking with me, asking me, "Hey, you want me to do something about your boy? I got people who can take care of him." And I, you know, kind of laughed with him about it. And then one of the other inmates, who was sort of a mentor to me, he took me aside afterwards. He said, "Listen, you shouldn't think one second about your friend." He said, "I've been in here for 9 years now, and my first 3.5 years were the hardest years of my life. My brother-in-law told the feds where my stash was. And I spent my first 3.5 years waking up every 20 minutes because I was dreaming about killing him." He's like, "And then one day, just magically, I just released it." He said, "It was the most important thing, you know, that's happened to me. You can't do time like that." And that was about the best advice I got in there. And from that day on, every day, you know, every day has been better than the one before. So I'll just close by saying, when you're locked up, there's around the perimeter of the institution, There's a line before the fence, and you're never supposed to go near the line. Because there's these three guys in this guard tower that have rifles trained in different directions just in case anybody tries to make a run for it. And because everyone in there knows that if you go near the line, you know, but somebody gets a little trigger happy up there and shoots you, probably the outside world's never going to know which side of the line you were on. And it was, I think, a pretty good metaphor for life and life in politics, or public life especially, which is that you should never even go near the line. Because, as with my case, you may inadvertently cross it and make a mistake that could cost you dearly. Thanks very much.
Our speaker is willing to take a few questions for the few minutes. So if anyone has any questions they want to ask him, please go to the mic and ask your question.
Does God play a part in your life?
I'm a person of faith. My wife's father is a preacher. And when I was locked up, I gained a new faith that I didn't have on the outside. I'd played drums my whole life in a rock band. And I ended up playing in the church choir when I went to prison. And getting back in touch with my spirituality in a way that I'd lost, frankly, before that. Thanks for the question.
How did you learn to trust after that? How long did that take?
Well, honestly, I would say that I haven't. And I wish I could be more optimistic. I mean, you know, I trust my wife. I trust my parents, trust my brother, and I have a ton of friends that stood by me. I had 9,000 numbers in my cell phone the day that I pled guilty, and I never heard from 8,000 of those people ever again. The 1,000 or so that reached out, and every day more reach out, and friend me on Facebook or, you know, whatever. But the people who wrote letters to the judge for me, it's almost 300 people wrote letters. A bunch of my colleagues in the state senate, the attorney general, the state auditor, lieutenant governor, wrote letters on my behalf asking for clemency. And I'll never, ever forget what those people did in standing by me at a very dark time. And so I can't even describe what I would do for any of those people. I would do anything for them. But trust is a different thing. And as one of my former colleagues, Rodney Hubbard, represented a district in North St. Louis, used to tell me, he'd say, never trust anybody but your mama, and keep one eye on her. I have. Few of the guys the warehouse, I mean, we it was quite a bonding experience. I mean, you're there from, you know, 8 hours a day, every day, and it's really, really hard work. And the first few weeks, I mean, they just got such a kick out of throwing like a 100-pound, like dropping a 100-pound bag of sugar onto me. I mean, even, you know, every morning I wake up now, I can feel my back. I can feel those bags of rice and beans. But there are two guys from the warehouse that I, you know, I send money to for Father's Day and Christmas and other holidays. You know, life in prison, a lot of people don't realize this, but they give you a little tiny bar of soap and a little toothbrush. You can't live a normal life. You know, there's a lot of things that you need that can make things more comfortable than you can get at a commissary. So if you know anyone in prison, you know, even if you send them $25, like, you have no idea how much more comfortable life can be if you can just have a jar of peanut butter for the days when what they serve is inedible. You know, I saw the stuff come in, and that was both good and bad. Because some of the food, you know, I mean, I was there in 2010, and there was food that had expiration dates in 2005. You know, boxes that said not for human consumption. I would say, you know, and I made the mistake. I'm not complaining about it. I'm just saying, if you know anybody in there, you could make their life a lot better by sending them a little money. So I send books in to a couple of those guys, and then they're not going to get out for a couple more years, but I'm already starting to put feelers out to try to help them get jobs when they come out. Then I have two friends. One was my cellmate, who's already out, and I stay in touch with him. And then another guy who I did time with, who I stayed in touch with. So it was pretty much, it was about 98% drug dealers. And then, you know, maybe 1% white collar people. I made a lot of friends on the basketball court. The biggest blessings for me, I mean, there are really three things that kept me safe. The guys at the warehouse, most importantly. Second, being able to play basketball. Although that I got in a fight on the basketball court and got hurt as well, but it helped me get some respect. And then people had read articles about the case, and they knew that. You know, my friend had worn the wire. And then since I had not cooperated by wearing a wire, you know, being a snitch in there is the two worst things to be are, you know, a snitch or a child molester. If you're suspected to be one of those two things, you're going to have an extraordinarily difficult time. Thanks for the question. My friend, I didn't fully explain the story because maybe I didn't have time, or maybe I just meant to get to it but didn't. But my friend had been he had helped me raise money in my first race, and he had given money to Skip, the guy who had done that postcard, and then after I won my Senate race, the Federal Election Commission. So the Federal Election Commission didn't do anything for 2 years. And then right after I won, then the case picked back up. Right after I came back and won for state Senate. And there's a lot of theories about why that is, but I won't go into that right now. But once the case came back up, my friend Steve called me and he said, Skip told me that the FEC wants to talk to him. And I said, that's not good. And he said, don't worry, I'll take care of it. And I said, okay. And then I found out years later, after I pled, that when Steve said he would take care of it, he said to Skip, don't worry, Jeff and I will take care of you. Like, basically, don't explain to the Federal Election Commission what happened. It makes more sense now because Skip came to me once I got to the Senate, and I was the chair of the Senate Democratic Campaign Committee, which meant I raised the money and helped oversee all the campaigns of people running for the Senate, Democrats running for the Senate around the state. And when I was doing that, Skip came to me and said, hey, I want to do all the direct mail for the state Senate. And he came about three times to me, figuring I would, I guess, take care of him. And I kept saying no, I wouldn't hire him. So when Skip got in trouble, I know it's so convoluted. I mean, I'm sure you're lost. I'm confused even explaining it. But after Skip got in all that trouble for like the car bombing and everything else, somehow the feds went to his condo. Maybe he directed them there, maybe they just went there. But he had tapes. He had tapes of like a decade of dealing with Missouri politicians. And he had been close to Governor Holden, he had claimed. He had been close to Lieutenant Governor Maxwell. He had tried to get in close with a lot of major political figures. And they found a tape, either they found a tape or they were directed to a tape of my friend Steve saying to him, "Don't worry, you know, we'll take care of you." And when they went to Steve's house, they played that tape for him, and then Steve quickly said, "Okay, I'll do whatever you need me to do."
Does this experience, is that the end of your political future?
Well, I still get a chance to have an impact on issues that I care about in a variety of ways. I'm actually the executive director of the Missouri Workforce Housing Association. That's a statewide association that advocates for the construction of more affordable housing for working people who are, you know, struggling to afford a decent place, or for seniors. And so I come back to Missouri, you know, once every 6 weeks or so and work on those issues. I see my former colleagues, you know, and I help. I still get to be active on a cause I care about. I travel around the country, and I talk about prison entrepreneurship and encourage people to, and then talk to legislators about alternative sentencing to help people in prison, I think, get back on their feet. You know, our recidivism rates are outrageous. More than half of all people reoffend within 5 years, and that's what's costing our state and states throughout the country so much money. And so if we actually made an effort to rehabilitate people in prison instead of just warehousing them, I think we would save tons of money on the back end. And so I talk about those issues. And then education policy was something I was very active on in the Senate, and I continue to talk to a lot of legislators about education policy, so at different levels. So I continue to be active in various policy realms that I've always been interested in. And then I write a lot about politics, you know, and comment on politics. So, you know, I have the political bug. I mean, I love it, and I love trying to make a difference on policy. And so I get a lot of the benefits that I used to have, but not everything, of course. He's gonna go away for a long, long time. He's been locked up. He was locked up on the initial charges, the mortgage fraud, bank fraud, weapons possession, drug distribution. He was locked up, and then I think he just pled guilty or was found guilty of the car bombing. But I think he'll probably be away for a while. I am writing about this. I've written most of a book manuscript about my experiences.
Ethically?
Yeah, it's got a substantial ethical component.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, I'll just close by saying, at that point, I would be presented with a choice, which would be to have my son go into politics or to remain married. And because my wife has already issued that ultimatum. But hey, thank you so much for the great questions, and thanks for being a great audience.